بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف المرسلين سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه ومن تبعه بإحسان إلى يوم الدين. Sisters and brothers, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. This course has been a source of agony for me because I am perhaps the least, and I'm not saying this to make a pretentious, honest, modest statement. I am the least qualified to talk about women inspired by the Beloved. I am the least qualified to talk about women, full stop. The women in my life are my mother and my wife. And that's it. No sisters, female associates, even in my very limited members of my family. But I'm a historian, so my friends are my books, my mother, my wife, discuss things with them, and the scholars. So for this course, I had to talk to a lot. I had to understand mentalities. There were things in history that, as a man, I wouldn't understand why a woman would do unless I understand that this who does this thing is a woman. So I learned a lot from what I read. And I am extremely grateful to IslamicCourses.com. I am grateful to Map Youth. I am grateful to everyone who made this occasion benefit. Even after tomorrow, you will not benefit much than myself. I know it's a very selfish statement, but no way am I going to be able in a couple of days to tell you all what I've read and all what I thought about. Sometimes you shed tears when you listen to stories. Sometimes you close your eyes and visualize this woman and how she moved in society. It goes beyond male stereotypes about even the most decent women in our Islamic history. So I have benefited a lot, and I hope that you will get some glimpses from what I have learned. In the past, I spoke about men in order to humanize them, so the four great imams. And then I wanted to give a message to Muslim people who feel a little bit frustrated when they read about great men and think that Imam Shafi'i was born great, or Imam Ahmed bin Hanbal was born great, or Imam Ibn Kathir was born a scholar. No. So I wanted to defy that logic by saying, no, they were children. And therefore, the second course was about children around the Prophet. Men are not born great. Men are born children. And then, through a process which women is part of, they become great. And then I said to myself, and no sister came to say to me that, which is a shame, but I said to myself, and you might smile and I don't care, if I was a sister attending talks for last 10 years, I don't want to say longer than that because you are quite young, 10 years, 5 years, all what I'm reading and hearing is, with all respect to those people, Umar, Ali, Uthman, Shafi'i, Ahmed, over 1,000 years, all these great people were men? What a boring stuff. You know, I see men everywhere. He's my husband, he's my father, he's my bullying little or younger or older brother. Even Islamic history is like that. So, hence this was the logic for women inspired by the Prophet. I think that this course should be given by a woman. Think about this scenario. Think about a sister giving a series of talks on great heroes in Islam. All of them are male. Think about what will happen to the male audience. Immediately, they might not say it to you in front of your face, but they will certainly say it even to themselves. You know, what does she know about all these, you know, men? What gave her the right to talk about these men? So, why do you accept a man talking to you about great women? Have you ever thought about this? Or, this is the norm, and now I'm used to it. I'm not trying to create a rebellious movement here. All what I'm trying to say to you is that this course has a function. This course has a role. This course wants to set a turning point and a precedence in educating men and women, yes, but women primarily, so that next time you come on stage, you come on stage as a mother, you come on stage as a sister, you come on stage as a wife, and teach the male audience how to treat their wives properly, how to treat their mothers properly, how to treat their sisters properly, because no, it doesn't matter how eloquent the male speaker is, I assure you, and I'm speaking about myself, I will never be able to appreciate the pain that a mother goes through when she is delivering her baby. I can talk to you, pain, P-A-I-N. But I will never feel it. Never. So you feel it. It will show in your words. It will show in the way that you speak. And you will have greater impact and effect to make on your audience. All what you need might be a little bit of knowledge. And knowledge is not a closet that has a key that is controlled by male. No, you can go to any good bookshop. Yes, the author might be a male at the end of the day. You can't escape from them. But at least you can have access to the knowledge. At least you can read and then begin to think about these themes and about these subjects in the same way that I did. I've written some aims here to do with this course, but I don't have to read all of them to you. They are in your handouts. But my major theme, my major aim, is to make you, male and female, have confidence in your Islamic history, have confidence in the human beings that made this history, and also believe deep-heartedly that women have been a major maker of that history. And if we were to omit women from history, there would not be Islamic history. How can you understand and appreciate the revelation without Khadija? How can you understand and appreciate the fiqh and the sunnah of over 2,000 hadiths without Aisha? How can you appreciate Abu Hanifa, Shafi'i, Ahmed, Malik, Ibn Anas, Rabi'a, etc., etc., without the mothers that decided when the husband died, when they were at their mid-20s, not to remarry, although they had the right to do so, but to live because, I'm not sure if they had this vision or not, because they felt that this person, this young boy, this teenager is great. He deserves that I commit my entire life for. Before you are grateful to Ahmed or Malik or Shafi'i, be grateful to the mothers who have decided to invest in them, because without them, I think they would be selling things on the streets simply because it was the mother that cared for them and protected them. We are not just talking about genius people, although they were, but we were talking about a normal logical process that was taking place. They say that women is half of the society. After reading a lot of these books, I began to think that women is the entire society. They constitute the half and they make the rest of the society. How did I organize this course? I was eager to make it unique, and I'm not sure if I succeeded in this or not. I'm aware that there are tapes and there are books and there is literature on women in Islam. So the first thing I said to myself, I am not going to do this course according to chronological order. I'm not interested, as a historian would be, in dates and in centuries. I am after women. Wherever the woman is, wherever the great woman is, I look for her, I register her story, and I feel that there is a story, there is a value that should be articulated. That is the story that I want. I came across loads of other stories, but I felt This is not compatible with people living in London or in the West. It might be compatible in the Middle East. This is good story, but it's not powerful enough. I need a very powerful story. So this is quite a selection of the various women that I came across. Now, how did I organize, therefore, my narrative? I organized my narrative according to titles. And I wanted to be as attractive, perhaps, as the commercial market when naming perfumes. Names such as Envy, Desire, just captions, titles. So I said, I'm not interested in names of women. I'm interested in values. And under each value comes whoever serves that value. So energy is one value. U-turn is another value. Connect. These are not perfume titles. This is women inspired by the beloved. So connect is one title. And they will make sense in due course, I hope. Made men. And this is deliberate. Made men. I.e. men were made by them. Success. Impact. Impact not as mothers on their children. No, impact on society. That society is useless, worthless without women. Not rhetorically speaking, realistically, and I'll prove it. Excel. Excel in knowledge, in aspiration, in ambition, in everything that you need to excel upon. Aspiration or himmah or tumuh. And finally, love, which I'm not ashamed of articulating, and you will be shocked to see stories of great lovers greater than Titanic, if you want. But great lovers, honest lovers, decent lovers, genuine lovers, and lovers before getting married. And don't stone me for that. Just be patient and listen. Okay, so these are our perfume titles, which will make sense in due course. But before I dwell into these titles, I wanted to situate or set the scene for the rest of the lectures by talking to you on women during the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And here I'm not interested in fiqh. I'm not interested on whether it's permissible that women travels alone, or I'm not interested in that. Go and ask scholars about these things. What I am interested in is to give you an overall picture of how women used to move in society. Visualize yourselves, okay? You wake up early in the morning, I don't know what you have, conflicts or whatever, and then you dress up. If you are a student, you go to university. This is the central line, metropolitan. You wait, mind the gap, you know, etc., etc. This is your daily, so you can visualize that. If I was to live 200 years and I read your diaries, oh, she used to live in London, commute from this, oh, and this sort of things. Oh, after 11th of September, hijab became problematic. Oh, teenagers, yes, drug addict, etc., etc. I can visualize, I can imagine. This is exactly what I would like you to get out of this lecture. How did women visualize women during the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam? Okay, by way of an introduction to the overall picture, these three elements is what I think constitute women during the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. 3 points. One is that Islam considers women to be Allah's vicegerent on earth, or Allah's khalifa. We always tend to think, especially the male, oh, Allah's khalifa on earth is Adam. No, Eve as well. So when Allah said to Al-Malaik, I'm going to create a khalifa, it's Adam and Eve. Have you ever thought about this? أَتَجْعَلُ فِيهَا مَنْ يَسْفِكُ الدِّمَاءِ Someone who would shed blood? A woman? Yes. Murderer. Killer. You know, shedding blood. A woman. Yes. No. إِنِّي أَعْلَمُ مَا لَا تَعْلَمُونَ Oh, so you will create people who are decent. Decent women, yes. Etc., etc. I'm just trying to womanize the way that we read this verse. So Islam considers women to be Allah's khalifa on earth, and that this role, therefore, is not just restricted to man. Number two, Islam recognizes the women's needs for worship, knowledge, work, and therefore does not restrict the role of women to home or to the private sphere. Number three, Islam respects women's potentials and talents and welcomes their contribution in service of their religion and society at large. Now, this is not philosophizing or trying to make Islam look appealing to the intellectuals. No, this is inspired from what I read regarding stories of women at the time of the Prophet. Okay, where do we see this at the time of the Prophet? First of all, we see it in women's or girls' right to choose who she wants to marry. Based on love or otherwise, I'll leave it to you. But based on a conscious decision that this is the one that I want, or this is the one that I am sure I don't want. And most of the hadiths that I will be reading are from Bukhari and Muslim. I might not have time to read it in both Arabic and English, but let's talk about the right to choose a spouse, and that is seen in this hadith where in Bukhari it says, a woman from the offspring of Ja'far ibn Abi Talib, a woman from the offspring of Ja'far was afraid lest her guardian marry her to somebody against her will. It's not that the nikah was conducted. No, she just had this idea, terrible idea, that her guardian one day might marry her to this person from I don't know where, because he happens to be her cousin. Okay, so she was afraid. So she sent for two elderly men from the Ansar. And they said to her, those two elderly men, don't be afraid. For Khansa bint Khaddam, another girl who was called Khansa bint Khaddam, was given by her father in marriage against her will, then the Prophet cancelled that marriage. You might not know about Khansa bint Khaddam, but she is famous for that story. The story was that her father wanted her to marry someone that she did not love. Or at least she never envisaged that one day she will love him. And she went to Rasulullah and Rasulullah cancelled the marriage. So Ansar said, oh sister, or oh girl, or oh daughter of Ja'far, don't worry. Nothing will happen to you because we have a precedence. Two things. Two comments that I have on this hadith. One is that the girl, whom we don't know her name, she didn't keep quiet. She didn't commit suicide. She didn't run away with her boyfriend. She didn't contact the police. She didn't go weeping under her pillow and said, قدر الله ما شاء فعل. She went and actively pursued her case to two trustworthy elderly men and expressed her fear. And this is what you should be doing. Not about marriage, about everything in life. Men and women, by the way. I like the signs in hospital. Do not suffer in silence. Okay? Do not suffer in silence. It doesn't mean that you talkative about everything and complain about, nagging about everything. No. We are talking about genuine sources of pain here. Okay, you don't want to end up marrying and then being divorced, becoming a single mother. So she went and she spoke and she was concerned about her life. Number two, society supported, recognized, respected her desire, her fear, her concern. And this respect was not rhetorical, it was realistic. It was not based on tradition by saying to her, no, no, respect your father, he's your cousin. At the end of the day, he speaks Urdu, or he speaks Arabic, or he speaks Punjabi. You know, we have to all retain our culture, obey your mother, etc., etc. They said to her, don't worry. because it happened that Rasulullah canceled a similar marriage. That means what? It means that we have a society that is supportive, but a society that takes as its reference point Islam and the actions of Rasulullah, not tradition, if tradition conflicts with religion. Incidentally, these are two elderly Ansar men, meaning that they were kuffar before, they were not born Muslims. It's amazing, maybe they became Muslims last year or 2 years ago. It's amazing how now they are beginning to think in new terms, even in very sensitive, culturally related issues such as marriage. Fascinating, that is, to me, at least. Okay, look at this other girl that her story is narrated in the book of Ibn Majah. The story says, a girl came to the Prophet ﷺ and complained that her father had married her to his nephew against her wish. The Prophet gave her the choice of rejecting the marriage. But she said to the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, look at what she said. I think this girl should be giving this lecture here. This girl said, I endorse what my father did, but I just wanted to show women that parents have nothing to do in that matter. I wanted to show women. Look at this woman who is thinking about women who might not be hearing her during that point, that instant, talking to Rasulullah privately, but feeling that she is responsible to setting a precedent for women during her life and for women at 2006 Birkbeck College. It's amazing. So the only comment I say in relation to this is, look at this woman, how it says girl, by the way, jariya or bint, not a woman, girl. I'm not sure, maybe teen or 20s. But look at how she feels that she is responsible for teaching men and women. I endorse what my father, don't ask me whether I love my nephew or not, but I accept the marriage. But I just wanted to make that point that no way in the future should someone accept marriage despite her will. Setting a precedent, a theoretical precedence. You might say, oh, you're being troublemaker. Why do you have to go and complain? You have already agreed to the marriage. No, it's a principle. Okay, so Islam, Rasulullah, maybe you can now visualize women in prophetic society. Women, she talks, she goes, she gets out of her house, she goes to two elderly men, discusses marriage, and then she goes to Rasulullah, Ya Rasulullah, by the way, you are invited to my marriage ceremony. I just wanted to make a point, he's my nephew. Initially, I had problems with it, etc. But inshallah, I'm agreeing. You know, come and visit us next time, inshallah, we will have a wedding. And maybe a few years, Ya Rasulullah, you remember my nephew now, he's a father. I brought him Hassan or Layla. Amazing. To see this progression, similar to this girl that wakes up conflicts and then mind the gap and takes the metropolitan line. So she is not minding the gap. She wants men to mind their own business when her future is something of concern. So in the same way that a sister, and Islam recognizes that, in the same way that a sister chooses her future spouse, she can choose to divorce. She can choose to end her relation with her current spouse. For all sorts of reasons. And the classic example is Zawjat, or the wife of Thabit ibn Qais. Incidentally, sometimes, and I asked some of the shuyukh on this, why do they say the wife of Thabit? Why don't they mention her name? This woman that committed adultery and came to said Rasulullah Sallam, I committed adultery, why don't we know her name? And some shuyukh said to me, that because the narrator is so sensitive to mentioning names of women in context of embarrassment. And that's why in context of pride, the woman's name is mentioned. In context of embarrassment, it's disguised to protect her honor. The wife of Thabit ibn Qais came to the Prophet ﷺ and said, I have a problem. I don't blame Thabit for defects in his character or his religion. Oh, I can see some problems now. But I, being a Muslim, dislike to behave in an un-Islamic manner if I continue to remain with him. On that, Allah's apostle or messenger said to her, will you give back the garden which your husband has given you as a dowry She said, yes. Then the Prophet said to Thabit, O Thabit, accept your garden and divorce her at once. 2 points. One is that Rasulullah ﷺ never enters into a discussion with her, trying to say to her, why? What's the nature of the problem? Do you have any children? What will you do after you divorce? What will society say about you? He didn't look, the hadith doesn't say anything. The hadith says, would you be prepared to return his garden for him? He's actually engaging in the procedure of divorce immediately. So he respects her feelings. He respects her emotions. He respects that this is a decision that she has thought about day and night, perhaps for months, until she was able to pronounce it to Rasulullah. And when the moment comes for a woman to come and speak, that means she had enough. And when a woman says, Ya Rasulullah, I fear that, إِنِّي أَخَافُ الْكُفْرِ, that's what she says, كُفْرَ الْعَشِيرِ, or I fear that I might become un-Islamic in manners. I don't know what this means. I shout a lot, I lose my temper, I swear at him, I commit sins basically by continuing to be with him. He's good. Thabit ibn Qais was a fascinating companion. He doesn't beat her or do anything bad to her. But it's just that he has problems as far as she's concerned. Incidentally, he had physical problems. And she didn't find him attractive. And Rasulullah ﷺ never discussed that. Never said, how dare you talk about looks? Of course, we're not talking about exaggerations that he has to be, I don't know, too tall or muscular. No, but he has to retain the minimum, the basic qualities that will make him acceptable. And Thabit ibn Qais, a great companion to a woman, was not like that. Sometimes I say to myself, Thabit ibn Qais, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, Az-Zubayr ibn al-Awwam, fascinating companions. I would like to do anything to make them happy. And then you read their stories and you see that the wife of Zubayr ibn al-Awwam wanted a divorce. You know what it tells you? It tells you that when a woman wants a divorce, she wouldn't care whether this is a companion or not. Because, well, obviously, whoever she marries afterwards is a companion by default. But the point is, oh, this is Zubayr, you know, fascinating warrior. I have to be with him so that people remember me in history as the wife of a Zubayr ibn al-Awwam. No. Zubayr ibn al-Awwam was a little bit harsh on women, and she could not bear being beaten by Zubayr ibn al-Awwam. Zubayr ibn al-Awwam is a great warrior, but maybe he turns the household into a battlefield. And that's why she wanted divorce. It's just a remark of trying to separate between our admiration to this human being and between those who were close to him and how they perceived him in a way that was totally different than the way that we perceived them. Number two comment on this hadith is that the woman is willing to compromise a garden, not a Mercedes or not a, I don't know, 2,000 pounds, or a garden, big garden, hadiqa, mazra'a, willing to return this garden. Why? Because she respects her feeling. I'm not going to live with him. I'm not going to cheat on him because I want the garden. I'm not going to say, oh Allah, bless him with martyrdom so that I can inherit the garden. No. Are you prepared to buy your happiness in this life by returning a garden? Yes. Are you sure? Yes. Simple as that. This is with regards to intimacy and intimate relationship. Okay, what about knowledge? Rasulullah ﷺ gives Friday ceremonies, khutbas. He gives public talks in the mosque. And of course, rest assured, that men and women used to attend. And without a segregation. But anyway, I don't want to enter into that. It will create problems. The mosque was small, and there were no segregation. Until Umar al-Khattab came and he undertook some procedures afterwards. But this is fiqh. The point I'm trying to make is that women was part and parcel of the daily ceremonies and khutbas that were taking place. Nonetheless, a woman thought that we deserve more time of Rasulullah ﷺ and more talks now directed towards women. So a woman came to Rasulullah ﷺ and said, and look at that, look at that. A woman could come to Rasulullah ﷺ and said, Ya Rasulullah, please, you know, spare us 5 minutes if you don't mind, just for the women. Look at the statement. She says, Ya Rasulullah, ذهب الرجال بحديثك. Ya Rasulullah, men have taken all your time. Men have taken all of your focus in your talks. This is a critical statement, isn't it? Can you visualize women now? That woman was bold. Woman spoke her mind. Not rude in the Western sense. No, she had courtesy. She was honest. She was modest. She lowered her gaze. I don't want you to understand here that I'm a feminist in the radical sense, in the Marxist sense, that, you know, to hell with all men, this patriarchal society. No. I am cautious to set the scene for you, women and how they moved in society. At the end of the day, women complained to a man. But this man was not talking on his male chauvinistic sentiments. He was a prophet, and she was realizing that she was talking to someone who is inspired. So she said, Ya Rasulullah, ذهب الرجال بحديثك. So men has taken most of your time. So please dedicate to us a day where you sit with us alone, without my husband, without my brother, and without my father-in-law even. الرسول صلى الله عليه وسلم said, اجتمعنا في يوم كذا وكذا في مكان كذا وكذا. He said, gather on that day in that place. Subhanallah. No posters. No, I'll check my schedule. I'll let you know. I'll text you. Well, email me. And I'll see my time. Immediately. I sometimes think as if the Prophet صلى الله عليه وسلم was one day expecting that to happen. But he was just waiting for her to come. He was just waiting to see, have I really produced good women that are active enough now to come and demand their rights for me, rather than me coming as a sister, would you like, inshallah, Wednesday after Maghrib, sit with you? No, I'm busy. No, she will come. She will demand. And this woman, by the way, was representing hundreds of women behind her. This woman is moving. Can you now have a, you know, I'm trying to just jot some, you know, in this, complete the jigsaw for you. Some pieces here and there about marriage, about knowledge, etc. 2 points. One is that women did not feel satisfied with what Rasulullah ﷺ was saying because they thought that this was general, but they wanted more specific talk in relation to women, which if anything shows that women were eager to learn more and more. Number two, Rasulullah ﷺ is so respective, so receptive, immediate receptiveness to this demand. These are 2 points about knowledge. Another aspect, which is participation in congregational public worships. And this, of course, includes the salah in the mosque. Aisha radiallahu anha said, in a hadith, the believing women, look at this hadith, the believing women covered with the veiling sheets used to attend the Fajr prayer with Allah's Messenger, and after finishing the prayer, they would return to their home and nobody could recognize them because of darkness. This is in Bukhari, Kitab al-Salat, Waqt al-Fajr, Fajr prayer. Now, 2 points. One is that Aisha, radiallahu anha, does not need to say this hadith to an audience that already are aware that women attends the prayers with the Rasulullah. She said, used to attend. That means that Aisha is actually talking to tabi'een, is not talking to companions. Number two, that means that Aisha is making a statement about a previous practice that is not anymore there. So she wants to tell them, by the way, the fact that we don't see women in Fajr prayer is something that was different than the time of Ar-Rasul sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. So if you want to be proper Salafis, we should see women in Fajr and in Isha prayer. Number three, she could have said the believing women covered with their veiling sheets used to attend the prayer with Allah's Messenger. But the fact is that she deliberately said the Fajr prayer, which is, in addition to Isha, a male-dominated time, a male-dominated prayer. 4 o'clock in the morning, would you see a woman in a mosque? You hardly see men even. But a woman knocking on the door of the muezzin, excuse me, brother, open the door. What? What are you doing? Where, you know, where? It's not. Where did you come from? I would like to pray Fajr prayer. What? Yes, because Aisha radiallahu anha said, كان نساء المؤمنات يشهدن مع رسول الله صلى الله عليه وسلم صلاة الفجر متلفعات بمروطهن ثم ينقلبن إلى بيوتهن حين يقضين الصلاة لا يعرفن أحدا من غلس. What? I didn't understand a word of what you said. And actually, I don't care. This is the situation. Okay, it's not that sarcastic, but this is the real situation. Is that women are absent, not just from Fajr, but from Isha. And then I sometimes think about that and say, well, maybe women don't want to attend the prayer because she's asleep. Because yesterday she was watching Friends. I'm not being harsh now on women, but I'm trying to say to you that this hadith also tells us that women used to pray Fajr because they used to sleep early and pray Fajr in Jama'ah. That means wake up an hour before. And those women, by the way, they were not losers. They were not sad people. They were not unemployed. They were not on pension. They were mothers, busy mothers. Have to feed their child, have to wake them up for school. But it's Fajr. It's my deen. Do you understand? Okay. Look at this, another hadith. It's also fascinating and shows the struggle between male desire for control and between male respect for Sharia. Ibn Umar, the son of Umar al-Khattab, says, one of the wives of Umar ibn al-Khattab used to offer the Fajr and the Isha prayer in congregation in the mosque. She was asked why she had come out for the prayer, as she knew that Umar disliked it. Look here, why do you attend Fajr knowing that Umar disliked it? Not a companion wouldn't say, why do you attend Fajr prayer? Because women are not supposed to attend Fajr prayer. You see, the logic is different. The logic is different. Which shows that it's taken for granted that women can go and pray for Fajr if the husband has no problems. But here, the husband has a problem, as we will come to know now. So she was asked why she had come out for the prayer, as she knew that Umar disliked it, and he has great ghayra, or self-respect, or he's jealous that to see his wife coming and out, in and out, in and out, in and out. In contrast to those that says that women should not go except on 2 occasions, when she leaves the household of her father for marriage and when she leaves her house to be buried. This is a well-known saying among some of the narrow-minded fuqaha. On 2 occasions only. So forget about Eid, forget about whatever. Forget about university, of course. So she says, she replied, what prevents him? She's saying to Ibn Umar, the son, not her son, because this is the son of another woman. Atika was another wife. So she said, what prevents him from stopping me from this act? Look at this fascinating question. If the question was not here, I would say, please, ask this question so that we understand why Umar did not prevent you. Because then we will have ijtihad. Maybe he was busy, maybe she went behind his back. But look at the answer. It sets aside everything else. He said, what stops him, stopping you, is the statement of Allah's Messenger. Do not stop Allah's women servants from going to Allah's mosques. So Umar now is making it known that he dislikes the fact that his wife, and this is emotion, this is sentiment. But practically he's not taking any action because there is a hadith. It's amazing to note that these people had feelings like us. They liked and disliked. They sometimes were violent, sometimes lost their temper. They were human beings. But when you said to them, Allah says this, and Rasul says this, they take off their hat and say, Sami'na. They don't say which madhab, which scholar. Maybe there is a different interpretation. Maybe it's mansukh. Maybe it's abrogated. Sami'na wa ata'na. Ibn Hajar, a famous hadith scholar, he said, when Umar ibn al-Khattab was stabbed and died in the mosque, his wife Atika was there. That means that Umar never attempted to stop his wife until he died. It's a fascinating quote by Ibn Hajar. فَلَقَدْ طُعِنَ عُمَرْ وَإِنَّهَا لَفِي الْمَسْجِدِ. It is as if the historian registered, Umar was stabbed. Number two, his wife was in the mosque. And she witnessed the stabbing. Therefore, number three, his wife continued to attend the mosque even till the last day of Umar's life. One, two, three. Please, please, please understand history like this. Understand your deen like this. There is no point of getting Sahih al-Bukhari and reading day and night and reading. Stop and think. And when you read al-Bukhari, this is just attending congregational prayers. She used to attend Salat al-Janazah, funeral prayer. She used to, of course, attend Hajj. What is more interesting is that they used to make i'tikaf. I'tikaf. Could you imagine going to the mosque and seeing a woman with a sleeping bag? Sister! Look at this hadith. An Aisha radiallahu anha, she said, the Prophet used to practice i'tikaf in the last 10 days of Ramadan till he died. And then his wives used to practice i'tikaf after him. Okay, this is a religious context. What about a non-religious or a social context where there is maybe an element of temptation, an element of a mixture, an element of looking at this girl or looking at this boy or I don't know what. Well, it happens all the time in the tube, in the university, in conferences, in camps. Women used to also participate in communal celebrations. Anas radiallahu anhu said, the Prophet saw women and children coming forward. They were returning from a wedding party. The Prophet stood up and said, by Allah, you are the most beloved people, O Ansar, to my heart. Imagine Rasul Sallam. You know, sometimes when I read these hadiths, I imagine them. I'm imagining children, 5 years, you know, with lollipops and ice cream. I don't know if they had ice cream, but running, running. Yes, mother. Yes, my sister. Oh, look at this handsome man. He's Rasul Sallam. Rasul Sallam, he doesn't say, oh, come, my boy, come and sit on my lap. No. He stands up and says, oh, Muhammad, Mahmoud, Ali, come. Oh, sister Amina, sister Aliya, wallahi, you are the most beloved people for me. Could you imagine that? Why are you saying that? You know, what's the context? The context is that these are decent human beings. They gave me protection. These are my future sons and daughters. These are my, in the age of my mothers and, you know, aunts and I do love them. The problem with us today is that we are embarrassed to mention the word love, because unfortunately the word has been hijacked by everyone, including gays and lesbians, and sorry to say this, except Muslim people who would say love, yes, love of Allah. Yes, I know love of Allah, love of my mother, love of Islam. What about love of women? What about love of children? What about a woman loving her husband? And what about a husband loving her woman? You don't have to, I'm sorry to say this, do everything in public like what others do. No, but at least retain the emotion and respect it, recognize its existence, and don't feel embarrassed to, not to articulate it, but to at least recognize that it's legitimate to have it, at least legitimate to have it. So Rasul stands up and says, Antum ahabbu nasi ilay, Ansar of Medina. Abu Bakr as-Siddiq, in another hadith, he says, when we came migrating from Mecca to Medina and we arrived at night, usually we think that they have arrived at daytime. When we arrived at night, we saw men and women stand on the tops of the houses. Women, they should be in bed. No, they were when we were at night. It was dark and I could see women. Abu Bakr, that is. Women and men standing on the top of the وتفرق الغلمان والخدم, and the children and the servants were in the بيوت and were in the houses and outside the houses. ينادون يا محمد يا رسول الله محمد أو رسول الله. And Rasulullah Sallam with Abu Bakr coming, and you know what would you imagine, brother? Don't smile, brother. What do you say, ya Muhammad? You know what are you talking about? You know you should respect the Prophet. No, children, women, men. It's a lively community in the middle of the night. You don't have to be Saturday night or Friday night. In the middle of the night, people are celebrating, not soccer or not the World Cup, celebrating the coming of a savior from Mecca to Medina. Everyone was celebrating. There wasn't a generational gap. You know, the young were saying, oh, what these elders? You know, who is this old man? You know, why should I be happy about him? Everyone was celebrating because they knew that this person was great and he deserves to be celebrated. You know, it's really fascinating. They not only used to participate in congregational occasions, they used to even participate in places where you would not expect women to be. And you are aware of this, and these are classic examples in battlefields. And one of the well-known female companions is Ar-Rabi' bint Mu'awad. She says, we were in the company of the Prophet during battlefields, doing what? Shouting and yelling and be careful. No, don't die. Don't, you know, be shaheed. No, they were not yelling. They were there doing a constructive job that without it even war would be impossible. We were in the company of the Prophet, providing the wounded with water, treating them and bringing the killed to Medina. Look at that. Bringing water. Imagine Khalid ibn al-Walid is fighting while he is dying out of thirst. Who will bring him the water? A woman. He drinks the water and continues to fight. You cannot appreciate Khalid ibn Walid's strength without appreciating Evian or whatever. But it's not the Evian, it's not the water. It's the sister that brought it to him in the midst of the battlefield. Oh, brother, take some water. You need it. It's good for you. Okay, forget about the water. Someone who is wounded, someone who's bleeding, but he can fight, but not now, tomorrow. That is, if he was to be treated. So, if you are 50 people fighting, 10 are wounded, tomorrow you will be 60, provided that those 10 are treated. If they are not treated, you will be 50. Do you understand? So, who contributes to the power of the Muslim army? Women. You know what I'm trying to tell you? I'm trying to tell you that even you cannot appreciate victory of Muslims in Uhud or in Badr without women bringing waters, without women providing men with first aid. And what else? Third, carrying the killed to Medina. Those killed could be buried in wherever, in Badr, in Uhud, wherever they are. No, I will carry them and I will bury them in Medina where they will die in a Muslim land. Who was doing this? A woman. Another thing which women did, which also defies stereotype, was talking about politics. This is not a male issue. This is politics is not, I understand now today in the West, this is an irrelevant point, but really it strikes me as a revolutionary point. Ibn Umar says, Hafsa, my sister, entered one day and said to me, أَعْلِمْتَ أَنَّ أَبَاكَ غَيْرَ مُسْتَخْلِفِ. Do you know that your father, Umar ibn al-Khattab, have not named a successor yet to him? Ibn Umar said, really? He didn't? She said, no. He said, Wallahi, I will have to speak to him about that. I will have to advise him to name a successor because of the problems of not naming a successor. Okay, few points. Let's have 1, 2, 3, 4 comments. Number one, a woman is informing a man who is well connected to the elites and to the policymakers, Ibn Umar that is, about something that this male elite doesn't know about. So we're not talking about CIA or FBI, but we are talking about a well-informed woman that knows what is going to happen to the ummah after a few days if her father was to be killed or to be deceased. Number one. Number two, we have a woman who cares about, and don't be offended, this is just sarcastic, we have a woman who cares about other than cooking, or nursery, or bringing children, or even getting a job and getting married and being pregnant and having children. We care about a woman. We are talking about women who is discussing whether we should vote for the Conservative or for the Labour, or we shouldn't be voting for either because of their policies towards Iraq, for example. Okay? So a woman is lobbying, a woman is informing. And look at something else, third point. Look at Umar ibn Umar when he narrates this hadith. He could have said to the historians and to you, one day I was informed, trustworthy sources, that my father have not named a successor. But look what he does. دخلت علي حفصة. حفصة, my sister, and he is not ashamed to mention her name. She came to me once and told me something that I was ignorant of. He's not a male chauvinistic, you know, not suppressing his mother, suppressing his sister, suppressing his wife. You know, I know everything. No, Hafsa. Although, incidentally, it's not this hadith, Hafsa, the Hafsa bit. It's not relevant to the hadith, is it? I mean, I can understand that there is a problem, that Umar have not named the Sahih. I can understand. It doesn't matter who told you. But it is as if Ibn Umar feels that it's important to promote his sister and not to be ashamed that he is promoting a woman and not to be ashamed of naming that woman. The fourth and final point, actually the fourth, and there is a small fifth point, the fourth is that he didn't say to her, that's not your business, whether he has named the successor or not. Why do you care about these things? How dare you care about? He knows best. He's Umar. Are you going to be better than him? No. He said to her, أَوَقَدْ فَعَلْ إِنَّهُ فَعَلْ. Really? Like a sister and brother to, really? My father Umar has not named. Yes, yes, he has. وَاللَّهِ لَأُكَلِّمَنَّ. And this is my final point, that Umar has been talked to by his son about a political issue because of the sister. Now, if the sister did not inform her brother would not have spoken to Umar, and Umar would not have named the successor. Isn't this an impact on politics? Is it? Tell me, yes or no? Yes, it's an impact. And I'm not talking to you about a party. I'm not talking about a councillor. I'm talking to you about a khalifa, about a prime minister, about a king, about a ruler, the top of the political ladder. Finally, mentioning the name of woman. And I thought this is also interesting and has to be brought up to understand women and how they used to be visualized in society. First of all, they were visual. They were not disguised. Sometimes, and you might laugh at this, have you ever watched programs on fish in the sea? Do you see how they travel in communities? Okay? Do you see suddenly how they move away from big fish? Do you see how suddenly they... This is what I sometimes see and witness before my eyes when I look at brothers, when they see sisters, or sisters when they see brothers. And I say to myself, you know, if a sister was walking in the streets of Mecca and she saw Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, oh, Abdullah, let's move this way. Or no, he's nice. Let's you know, come and talk to him and chat. No. I'll just walk, I'll lower my gaze and walk on my way. Okay, this person over there, does he know me? Yes, he knows you. Because you are his sister. He sees you 5 times a day. He doesn't see you on occasions. Islam Expo or on when there is summer tours. Oh yes, long time no see. Are you still alive? I thought you were dead. No. They saw each other 5 times a day. Did they know that this is me? That this is Zainab? This is Alia? This is Amal? This is Muna? Yes, they knew. Okay, when they called me, what did they say? Sister Alia? No. Alia. Listen to two brothers when they talk. And if the brother wants to make a point that he deals with that sister in a very professional way, and there is nothing in between them. Did you speak to Sister Samia? Yes, I spoke to Sister Samia, and Sister Samia said to me that the room is booked. And Sister Samia also said to me, and sister, and perhaps Samia is once, or the sister, sometimes the sister. And Samia is disguised, you know, I know she's dead or something. But the sister is there. When I read Bukhari, an Aisha, an Safiya, it doesn't, an Ukht Aisha, an Ukhti Aisha, Sister Aisha said. Go and read Bukhari. Listen to this hadith. Marra rajulan min al-ansar. This is the hadith in Arabic, and it's quite long, so I'll read it in English. Safiya, the wife of the Prophet, told me that she went to Allah's Messenger to visit him in the mosque. So she visited him in the mosque and she spoke with Rasulullah. Then when Safiya and Rasulullah, when they reached the gate of the mosque opposite the door of Salama, because Salama, the wife of Rasulullah, lived, you know, next to the mosque, two Ansari men were passing by and they greeted Allah's Messenger. Look, this is not fish now moving. No, greeting. Yes, he's talking to her. But still, women and a man in private is a little bit suspicious. So they ran away a little bit. After greeting, they ran away. Salaam alaikum. I think, you know, it's like sometimes when you are, I don't know, in Russell Square, Saturday night, and you are walking and you see a brother. Salaam alaikum. Alaikum salaam. And, you know, you are greeting to recognize that you've seen him, but something, you know, what the hell are you doing here now at this time of the hour? So Rasulullah said to them, don't run away. And subhanAllah, he addressed this emotional concern and said, she is Safiya bint Yahya. She's not Ukht Safiya. She's not your mother, mother of the believer. She's not Innaha Ummukum. And if she said, if Rasulullah said Ummukum, he would be right, because they are Ummahat al-Mu'mineen. But she is Safiya bint Yahya. In another hadith, actually, which is more perhaps direct than that, that the wife of Abdullah ibn Mas'ud is called Zainab. She wanted to ask Rasulullah a question in relation to her giving zakat to her husband, because he was extremely poor. And she said to Abdullah Mas'ud, go and ask Rasulullah. He said, no, it's very embarrassing. You go and ask him. So she went, and Bilal radiallahu anhu, the mu'adhin Rasulullah, he was standing outside the house of Rasulullah, just giving permission to whoever wants to ask a question. He will take the question, come inside and ask it, bring the answer, and come out to the questioner and deliver the answer to him. So the woman says, when I arrived at the house of Prophet ﷺ, I saw Bilal and I saw a woman that had the same question as my question. Anyway, so I said to Bilal, go and ask Rasulullah if you would about this question. Can I give zakat to my husband? The hadith is too long, but the point I'm trying to get at is that Ar-Rasul ﷺ said to him, Bilal said, there are two women outside, Imra'a min al-Ansar, Imra'a from al-Ansar, because I know all the Imra'a. Bilal, it's fascinating. Bilal knows every woman from Mecca. So she's not from Mecca, therefore she's from Ansar. But that's not the point. The point is the other girl, the other woman. And Zainab. Not Sister Zainab. Look at what the Rasul said. The Rasul said, okay, said, oh, could have said, okay, what's the question? No. He said, wa ayyu Zainab? Which Zainab? Number one, there are many Zainabs in Medina. Number two, Rasulullah knows them all. Number three, when he said to him, it is the Zainab who is the wife of Abdullah Mas'ud. That means Bilal not only knows the women and their names, he even knows who is married and to who. He knows who is from Mecca. He knows who is from Medina. He knows their names. And he knows whether she is married or not, and if she is married, married to who. It's not just Bilal, it's Rasulullah as well. Because he says, ah, Zainab, the wife of Abdullah Mas'ud, tell her that it's halal and it's permissible to give zakat to Abdullah ibn Mas'ud. The final thing with regards to names is that, what's your name? My name is Hisham ibn Abdul Rahman. Muhammad ibn Adil. What's your name? You. Ahmed. You. Sajid ibn, the son of Sabir, okay. I want a sister who is willing to volunteer her name. You can say sister, I'm sister, whatever. Yes. Aisha, son of daughter of who? Huh? Iftikhar. Okay, what is common here? Okay, the uncommon is that female names. The common is that you are the son or the daughter of a male. Can you be the son or a daughter of a female? You know that Ali ibn Abi Talib had a well-known son called Muhammad. You know what was his name? If Muhammad was here, and I would say to him, Brother Muhammad, please introduce yourself. He would say, Assalamu alaikum. My name is Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya. And Hanafiyya is his mother. You know Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, Rasulullah says, if you want to listen to the Quran as if it was revealed to me, listen to Ibn Abd. Ibn Abd. Listen to the son of the mother of Abd. Abdullah ibn Mas'ud. And who was the muaddin of Rasulullah? Bilal. But there was another muaddin. Ibn Maktoum. Have you heard of this companion? Ibn not Ibn Abu Maktoum. Ibn Maktoum. What is fascinating now, what is fascinating, is that those men never felt ashamed to be called like this in a male-dominated society, if we suppose that this was a male-dominated society. He never felt embarrassed before his daughter or his son or his colleagues or his friends in the mosque. He never felt embarrassed before his wife to be identified with his mother. Because to him, his mother is a source of pride, not a source of embarrassment. This is the introduction for women inspired by the beloved. It's not women inspired by the beloved. It's setting the scene, situating the topic. I haven't introduced any women yet. I haven't zoomed the camera on any women yet. I haven't attempted to establish a relationship between you and any woman yet. This would need you to wake up, put some water on your face, and sit back, relax, and enjoy what is yet to come. قولوا قولي هذا واستغفر الله لي ولكم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.